For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is the pride of Southern California, Caitlin Bailey. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am wonderful. How about you, Mark?
Wonderful, I think, if anything, is an understatement. And I am quite well myself. Thank you very much. I am Mark Bigney, your other co-host. We're going to be talking about video games this week. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to talk about a retro game, The World Ends With You, in our Gaming Opinions on Old School Funware, a.k.a. Goof. Our feature game this week is Pentiment by Obsidian Games, and we're going to close it out by shouting out some upcoming titles that have caught our eye. So, Caitlin, what have you been up to lately?
All right, so I'm still kind of in a post-Veilguard slump, so I've played a bunch of different things for not very long.
Have you been finding cats?
I did find some more cats, yes.
Oh, that's great.
So one of our listeners actually wrote in and suggested another hidden cat finding game, and it's Cats Hidden In, insert location here. So
so instead of X full of cats, it's Cats Hidden In X?
Yes. So there was a bundle that was under $10, so I was like, okay, sure, and picked it up. So I played three of them so far. I played Cats Hidden In Germany, Cats Hidden In Italy, and Cats Hidden In China. Germany is the newest one. Italy is one of the oldest. I don't think it is the oldest. I believe there's also, there's one or two that are free to play. So if you're interested in hidden cat games, you should check it out. It's very cute. It's very similar to a X full of cats. This is all black and white versus full of cats being more like gradients with the backgrounds, but still really cute line art. You click on cats. Very similar gameplay otherwise.
It always seems to me in board games, whenever they seek to have like a themed location, it always strikes me as, I'm not going to say to the point of being offensive, but it always seems like the lowest common denominator. It's like, okay, well, this is Cats Hidden In Germany and there are lederhosen and sausages and beer all over the place. I'm like, seriously, is this how we're doing? Is that how it is in Cats Hidden In X?
I mean, the art is very clearly, like, there's a lot of, I don't know, more architectural elements in this compared to a something full of cats, which is cool. So it feels tasteful, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It doesn't feel like borderline racist or or anything just, else. So
I guess the term I'd use is reductive and consequently rather lazy and stereotypical. I mean, that's the thing with so many of these stereotypes. It's not even that I'm offended. It's just that it's lazy and uninteresting. So I'm glad that they've definitely put in the work, as it seems.
Yeah, I think so.
If you had to choose between these two series, what would you recommend?
Between them, I think I vibe a little bit more with a X full of cats, but both of them are quite good. I think the X full of cats series, the games tend to be a little bit, there's a little more to do. That said, I haven't played Cats Hidden Around the World, which is the $5 one in that pack that I picked up, and that one I think there's supposed to be a lot more cats, but the others there's 100 and you're done. So
okay, well, I mean, more cats I suppose is a given. It's just that the X full of cats, you were talking about various things like boss battles. I started poking at various questions and you actually started to say these might be borderline spoilers, and that blew my mind. And I'm getting the impression that Cats Hidden In X doesn't quite have that level of sophistication.
No, it does not go that far. There's no talking cats giving you quests, and that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Again, I don't mean when I say that something is sophisticated, sometimes sophisticated can work at cross purposes, mentioning no Pentiments in particular. but I'm glad that you've been finding more cats. And this is still, you say you're still in the sort of the post-Veilguard slump. You're not ready to commit to anything of serious consequence.
Well, I think I'm slightly coming out of it now because there's two other games that I gave some time to. One is Luma Island, which just came out, which is a cozy kind of like Stardew Valley-esque style game. I've been playing it co-op with a friend. I haven't played for too long, just a few hours, but that's been really fun and has been a nice way to, you know, take up my time. And the other is actually Inscription. I started playing it.
Oh my goodness, Caitlin, this makes me so happy. Do you know why? I get to pass the baton to you. Any listeners that have any comments about how Inscription ought to be played or experienced, I will direct all of your attentions, messages, missives, and communications to Caitlin Bailey.
So yeah, I'm probably not going to go into Inscription too much today just because I can't talk about three different games all in a row. But I'm having a lot of fun with it. I started it up yesterday on a whim, and I played it for longer than I'm comfortable admitting. Although everybody knows I beat Dragon Age in less than a week, so you know how I work.
You're just very committed.
Yes. What have you been up to lately?
So there's a company called Bitmap Books. And they publish a series of lavishly illustrated, very, very large, heavy... I would call them coffee table books, except they're very thick. And so there's been a history of The King of Fighters. There's been a history of SNK. Obviously, anyone who knows my gaming taste knows I was a big, big fan of those. There's also their visual history, a sort of a compendium of beat-em-up games called Go Straight, named after the iconic track from Streets of Rage 2. And one of their more recent offerings is a collection of run-and-gun games called Run-and-Gun. And so I've been looking through that, and I immediately went to some of my all-time favorites. For example, you can tell that this is a book of quality because it talks about how Shock Troopers, something we've discussed on this podcast, is criminally underrated and under-discussed in the history of run-and-gun games. And so these people know what's up. These are it-getters, these people at Bitmap Books. And I tripped over the entry for Exit the Gungeon. So Exit the Gungeon is the pseudo-sequel to Enter the Gungeon. Enter the Gungeon was published in 2016 by Dodge Roll and is a very well-known indie roguelite involving a sort of isometric perspective with the aforementioned dodge rolls, many, many, many different kinds of guns. I sunk a lot of time into Enter the Gungeon. This is one of those indie games that I played through twice. Once on the PlayStation, I believe the PlayStation 4, and once on the PC. I have not repurchased it for the necessary third time, because the natural progression you see at this point would then be to rebuy it on the Switch, but I don't like the Switch, so I haven't bought it for the Switch. And Enter the Gungeon was characterized by a lot of variety and a very, very strong sense of humor. The basic thrust of the game was that there's this gungeon and a lot of gun-based puns. So the enemies were walking bullets that would shoot guns at you. There was indeed a lot of similar pun and visual inspiration in terms of the actual weapons. So, for example, there was also a bullet, which was a gun that you could pick up. And this bullet would fire pistols that would then fire more bullets. There was a lowercase r that you would hold like a gun, and it would spew out bullets that would spell out bullet. And it would say bullet as you did so. There's a Nintendo D-pad that would shoot bullets out in four directions.
Incredible.
My personal favorite was the barrel. The barrel shot fish. And it explained that the gungeon spoke English as a second language, and so it misunderstood common idioms. So rather than shooting fish in a barrel, you shot fish from a barrel. Just endless jokes like this of this nature, but at the same time, a whole bunch of real-world guns, not like to tremendous detail. We're talking like AK-47s and M16s and various Colt revolvers and such. And as I say, I went through a lot of Enter the Gungeon, played the ever-loving crap out of it, but I never played Exit the Gungeon, in part because the ratings on Steam for Enter the Gungeon at various times have been overwhelmingly positive, whereas the best that Exit the Gungeon has ever done is mostly positive, and it's never been really strongly appreciated. So I'm like, okay, whatever. I picked it up a while ago as some sort of crazy sale bundle thing, but I never played it. But there was a mention in the Run and Gun book about one of the central conceits about Exit the Gungeon, and that made me decide to give it a try, and that is that at the start of every run, Caliber, the goddess of firearms, blesses your gun, and consequently, every 5 seconds, your gun changes into a different gun and just cycle through the available weaponry. One of my key problems in video games, and I think you have some of the same difficulties, is I'm going to end a game with tons of spare ammo, tons of unused disposables. This is a common issue. And so consequently, if I get a really, really cool firearm in Enter the Gungeon, I'm never going to use it because I want to save it for the right time, and then the right time never comes. I'm just too conservative with it. But if you tell me that I've only got the gun for the next 5 seconds, and during that 5 seconds I've got unlimited ammo, well, weapons free, and I could just go to town. And so I was very interested in exploring the arsenal of Enter the Gungeon in this way. It seems like a delightfully stress-free way to do it. This kind of sort of works. The problem is that the randomization is oddly strange. Like, there's this one weapon called the Anvilion, which is a crate that fires anvils. It's a very sort of Warner Brothers cartoons kind of vibe. And I always seem to end up with the Anvilion, like, all the time. Like, practically every run. It's very strange. I respect the fact that I'm starting up a roguelite structure game for the first time. I don't have access to all the unlockables. That's fine. Mm-hmm. I gotta unlock more stuff. But even then, there was a huge arsenal in Enter the Gungeon. Why are you making me feel like it's so small? Why am I encountering the same guns over and over? That was bizarre. And so that helped me understand part of the misgivings about it. The level design is also weird. So it's a side perspective rather than isometric top-down. And so it feels a little bit more like an action platformer at times. It is explained that the jump is basically a dodge roll in the air. And so you can dodge roll, but you can also jump. But you can't fire while you're jumping. So you're invulnerable while jumping, and you can't fire when you're jumping. So that's a little counterintuitive. But it allows you to play around with level design in a way that Exit the Gungeon does, but not all the time. There's some really cool set pieces in Exit the Gungeon, where elevator platforms are dropping off, so you're constantly having to move from place to place, or you're going to fall off the edge of the map, or you're being chased by a giant monster at the side of the screen, so you've got to navigate the platform so you can keep moving right, but at the same time dealing with all these enemies that are firing at you. During those periods, Exit the Gungeon is very good. During a lot of the rest of the time, though, you're just at a flat elevator screen where there's just a couple platforms to jump on, and that's it. And the geography of the game feels very constrained and very claustrophobic in an unfun way. And so when it works, Exit the Gungeon works real well and shows a very interesting spin on Enter the Gungeon. The rest of the time, I feel like it's squandering its opportunity. Now, I don't know how far this is going to get me. I'm only a few hours into my experience with Exit the Gungeon. I understand where a lot of the disappointment comes from, and it's a very uneven experience. But I want to see whether going through for a little bit and unlocking more of the guns in the arsenal will help with the sense of variety, like if the Anvilion quotient will go down. I don't mind being saddled with bad weapons. That's part of the appeal. But it's just this one specific weapon over and over again. And like, again, dudes, there are dozens and dozens and dozens. Why am I constantly running up against the same gun? It's so strange. One thing, though, that definitely makes me want to continue is the following detail that I will throw in because, Caitlin, especially this week, you've been reemphasizing your sense of priority. One of the characters in Enter the Gungeon, her special ability is that she comes with a dog. And the dog is adorable, has a little bow, and the dog can dig up special power-ups for you in Enter the Gungeon, find secret doors, find cursed chests, all those kinds of things. In Exit the Gungeon, because now instead of it being a top-down perspective, it's a sideways perspective. You have to jump on platforms, and you figure, how is the dog going to go do its business? Well, they've decided to not do its business. That's not what I meant. I'm very sorry. That was the wrong
word.
Wrong word, wrong, not in the context of dogs, Mark. How is the dog going to be able to execute its official duties? Okay, now I sound like I'm making a euphemism. Anyway, you get the idea. How's the dog going to work? And the answer is tiny dog with a jetpack.
Yes.
Suspended there with an adorable little jetpack, and anytime there's a power up for it to go fetch, it just flies off towards it to get it for you. And it's just aggressively adorable. And a lot of the visual charm of Enter the Gungeon has been persisted. I will end, though, with one very minor nitpick, but it's bothering me far more than it should. And that is, they've reused a lot of the graphical assets from Enter the Gungeon. No objections. They've reused a lot of the audio assets from Enter the Gungeon. No objections. But all the new visual assets are high res when the rest of the game is old style 16-bit-ish graphics. They clash very, very profoundly. And it's not like they had to do things this way. Like, for example, they made new pictures of all the characters in a much higher definition. there were already shots in Enter the Gungeon that replicate the same, broadly the same angle of all these same characters, but they redid them all. And every time they show up, they don't look like they belong in the same game. And on top of that, there are these loading transition screens that are also, again, very high res. It's weird. So suffice to say, there's a fair amount of things in Exit the Gungeon that are a little strange. And as a longtime fan of Enter the Gungeon, it is mostly giving me what I wanted. I just wanted to be able to play around with the guns with no sense of feeling hung up about wasting ammo. And I'm getting that most of the time. And I was unprepared for how boring the level design was going to be much of the time, and how exciting the level design was going to be when it's not being boring. So it's very much an uneven experience, as I said. I'll probably be going back now and then. This is not going to be the kind of single-minded obsession that I had for Enter the Gungeon for a very, very long time. But I am interested in seeing what the game is like at its best. So that is Exit the Gungeon by Dodge Roll. Exit was released in 2020. Have you ever entered the Gungeon, Caitlin?
I have not ever entered the Gungeon. It's been on my list of stuff to get to one day, but I have not done it yet. Actually, I don't think I own that one, which is surprising. I never managed to pick it up during a Steam sale.
But I don't think that's possible. I think every month you purchase the Omni Bundle, which is to say everything on Steam.
Thankfully, I'm not there quite yet.
My impression is mistaken. I apologize. So let us move on to gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof. Pursuant to patron request, we allow our patrons on patreon.com/amfad to vote on what we cover. And there was a tie, and so we talked about The Lost Vikings not too long ago. And now we're going to be talking about the Nintendo DS game, The World Ends With You. This was designed by Square Enix, published in 2007. This is a game that I played upon release on original hardware, and I replayed recently on my Surface Duo with an attached controller. More on that in a moment. And Caitlin, you played it on original hardware recently, right?
So I originally was going to do that, and then I couldn't figure out where the actual game was, so I ended up buying The World Ends With You Final Remix for Nintendo Switch.
Oh, Caitlin, no! No! Oh, boy. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Okay, so here's the thing. So you played it on the Switch with waggly controls, yes?
I played it with the touchscreen controls.
Oh, okay.
I can't. Okay, honestly, I don't love either. I don't like touching the screen because I don't like touching screens. But I also, I mean, whatever. Phone is different. Phone is like, you know, you're allowed to touch that screen, but touching the Switch screen feels weird. But I can't handle the motion controls. I've always hated them, and it's a reason why I didn't get as into Wii era consoles as much as maybe some other people did.
The motion controls for The World Ends With You on Switch are, frankly, quite bad.
Okay.
So this is unfortunate because The World Ends With You is rather a rare title. Why don't you give us a brief rundown on what happens in The World Ends With You?
In The World Ends With You, you're the main character, Neku. He wakes up in the middle of Shibuya Crossing in Japan, and he's Mark's favorite trope. He doesn't know anything about who he is or where he is or why he's there, but apparently he's playing some kind of Reaper game where he is going to be erased if he doesn't do certain tasks by the time the timer that is written on his palm runs out.
Neku is the union of two of my favorite tropes.
Yes, it is.
One of them is the amnesiac, and the other, and this is a non-trivial criticism, by the way. This isn't, it is pretty funny, but the other thing that I hate is the unnecessarily rude, unkind, mean, and cruel protagonist.
Yeah, he sucks and so much.
Neku sucks so hard, Caitlin.
So hard.
I had forgotten how hard Neku. I remembered he was a misanthropic jerk. I had forgotten to what extent, because right from the start, you have access to his inner monologue. It would have been fine for him to think the most antisocial thoughts imaginable, and then for him to be, like, uncommunicative and vaguely surly, rather than openly, verbally abusive to everyone. And frankly, the dynamic between him and his partner, because he ends up partnered with this young woman named Shiki, and he's just terrible to her all the time, and she takes it all the time. And she's like, hey, Neku, let's go do this thing. I'm here to support you. And he's like, shut up, stalker. You're terrible. And runs off by himself. And then she goes and saves his ass. And yeah. like over and over and over again, it makes me deeply uncomfortable, frankly, because it's just an unpleasant dynamic. Mm-hmm. And by implication, we are the ones controlling Neku. And the gender dynamics are just, you know, palpably there. And it's awkward and terrible. And I hate it.
Yeah, it feels abusive, and she has to stick with him because they have a pact, and they literally have to rely on each other to get through this next week of the Reaper game, and it's like, he sucks so bad!
I would have had so much more respect for Shiki and for the story of The World Ends With You if at some point relatively on she'd be like, look, Neku, I'm not inclined to be nice to you. I have to work with you. Could you shut the F up so we could get this job done so we survive? But no, that would have been fine. Then it would have been okay, whatever. Like, I don't have to have people be pleasant or pleasant to each other in fiction. Like, I like The Leftovers, and The Leftovers consist of nothing more than sad people being sad at each other all the time. It's a thing. It's a choice.
Yeah. But
it's a dynamic that you see very often in shoujo manga, for example, in particular. It's one of the reasons why, I mean, I like a lot of shoujo manga, but so much shoujo manga, you know, the male lead is an aggressive douchebag, and the female lead just takes it. And I hate it. I don't like it. It's unpleasant. That having been said, in the DS version, the gameplay elements kind of dovetail in with a lot of these story themes of the necessity of working together, of collaboration, of all those other things, because... for all of my misgivings about the plot and the writing and the characters, and there are considerable, The World Ends With You is perhaps the biggest justification for the DS in the entire history of its catalog. Because, look, Nintendo loves their gimmicks. And by the time of the 3DS, for what it's worth, I don't have a lot of experience with the 3DS catalog. By the time of the 3DS, many developers had just been like, oh, okay, well, the other screen's superfluous. Stick the map down there. A number of DS games did that, too. But by the time of the 3DS, it was almost universal. But The World Ends With You, if you're going to play the DS version, you need both screens at all times. And the battle system is so awesome. I am hard-pressed. See, I was going to ask you if you could think of a better action RPG battle system. The problem is, Caitlin, you haven't experienced it, because in the Switch version, it's one screen.
Yeah.
So how did you like the version you played?
It was fine. Like I said, I don't love touching the screen. I much preferred in the DS days having the stylus, just because, I don't know, the stylus is smaller than a finger. And I can't imagine what it's like to be like a person with large hands, because it's like, oh, yeah, you're just covering the entire screen at all times. But regardless... Yeah,
I feel seen. I think this may be might constitute a microaggression. Yes, I do have some meaty mitts. Fortunately, as I was saying, I wasn't playing on original hardware. I was playing on my Surface Duo, which has these lovely 5-inch AMOLED screens in 4:3 orientation. And so I can use a stylus. I can use my meaty index sausage fingers. That's fine. And what I vaguely remember, as I said, I played it in 2007, 2008. I vaguely remembered the tapping things and slashing at things to attack them. But what I'd forgotten was how it dovetails in with all the other stuff you have to manage, namely getting Neku out of dodge, and the fact that while you're slashing and activating all your various things, because you acquire dozens of different powers for Neku to use that work on different touch activations. Some of them involve flinging objects at enemies. Some of them involve firing bullets. Sometimes you slash over them. You slash over Neku. You slash up. You slash down. You circle things. Anyway, it basically looks at Pokemon Ranger and say, really? That's all you got? And just really blows open the sphere of what you can do with touch controls in an action RPG setting. And then on top of that, and this is something that you don't have any experience with, I don't think, the top screen is where you manage Shiki. And for that, you need to work the directional pad or the four face buttons. And she's doing her own attack combos. And on top of that, there's this weird guessing slash memory element game. And you're doing all this at the same time. And if you can get them all to work properly and you manage the timing well, you can make the game systems sing. And there's a tremendous difference. There's a very high skill ceiling for The World Ends With You. Because if you can get both of those screens to work on the same wavelength, which again has kind of narrative overtones, you're going to be triggering lots of combos and avoiding all the damage and getting things done real quickly, and that increases your experience gain, etc., etc. I had completely forgotten how satisfying it is.
Interesting. Yeah, so I think that the Switch version just completely destroys the whole Shiki screen.
Yep.
In order it's to gone. Get her to do anything, I'm pretty sure I just tap on the enemy. It's a little confusing because there's so many different things that you can do either on or near the enemy, but I'm pretty sure tapping on the enemy is the thing that activates Shiki, and you just have to tap multiple times to get her to do a combo. So it's really underwhelming, it sounds, compared to what the previous like top screen used to do.
The ports are universally reviled. So there was an Android version, there's an iOS version, and then the mm-hmm. Switch version is a redevelopment of those. And anybody who's played the original, I've never heard a good word about the ports from anyone who's played the original. People appreciate the updated graphics because, yeah, the graphics are pretty lo-fi. The music is interesting on the DS version, but again, memory limitations and audio limitations and all those other things. So people like the improved graphics, people like the new side missions, people like the additional writing, etc., etc. But the consensus view is that the battle system cannot hold a candle to the original. And it's truly a shame because you said you were going to be playing it on the original hardware, and I was looking forward to...
That was the plan, and then I didn't go... I had to go to the storage unit, and I just didn't do it. I have a lot of work to do this week.
I'm just sad for your sake, because as I said, yeah. I had completely forgotten how good the battle system was, and I'm hard-pressed to think of a better action RPG system anywhere, ever, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, Elden Ring's combat system, the Soulsborne combat systems, those are endlessly satisfying, but they're not really necessarily really clever or supremely iconoclastic.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily well executed and finely balanced and well honed. But The World Ends With You is one of those games where it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, you like really take advantage of the hardware, really take advantage of the format, do something different, require me to juggle different balls in the air at the same time, each of which are novel and interesting in and of themselves. And it all comes together really beautifully, which is even all the more striking because, again, you know, talking about Pokemon Ranger or any number of other DS games where it's like clear that this was just a bunch of gimmicks to justify a weird set of hardware choices. Now, as a consequence, it's almost impossible to port. Like again, the Switch port is anemic for a reason. It doesn't have the hardware to do what it needs to be done. So this is one of those things where you kind of need the DS or a very specialized setup.
Yeah, I mean, you talking about all of this stuff definitely makes me think that, you know, even though I didn't do it in this last week, the next time I go, I will definitely pick up the actual copy of The World Ends With You and try it on the DS.
And for what it's worth, that white DSi is a sexy piece of hardware, to be frank. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of misgivings about a lot of Nintendo offerings, and I never really got into the 3DS, and I will happily complain about the Switch 24 hours out of 24, 7 days a week, 365. But the DSi, oh, what a sleek, beautiful piece of hardware that was. The original DS hardware was kind of clunky and looked like a toy.
Oh, it had like all those weird angles and curves, and it was just like,
yep.
What are you doing? Yes, okay, so I do think I had a DSi. It was the Gold Zelda edition, maybe, but it has this shell, so it's like definitely the more rectangular, normal shaped.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ooh, that looks pretty good, too. I mean, it's awfully shiny and gold, but it's just got the subtle Triforce thing. Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, some of these look real shiny. This was normal shiny.
I just have really fond memories of my commute to work when I was teaching at MCPHS University. And there I was in my suit, and I would do one of two things. I would either prepare for my lecture on medical ethics, or I would play on my DSi. I remember I had the Bleach game, and I'd play The World Ends With You. It was good times. I'm not disappointed for me, Caitlin. I'm disappointed for you. The World Ends With You is just a tremendous experience. And sadly, you got all the abuse and none of the cool touchscreen action.
Yep. It's a bummer. I will definitely give it a shot with the real the real thing once I get a hold of it, because that sounds cool and interesting, even if I don't play through the whole game, or even if I do. I don't know. We'll see.
So those are gaming opinions on old school funware. We now move on to our feature game, Pentiment. Caitlin, tell us all about Pentiment.
Pentiment came out in 2022. It was developed by Obsidian Entertainment and published by Xbox Game Studios. And it was released on a bunch of systems. I think Windows, whatever versions of Xbox were out at the time. I think the One and then the Series XS. Xbox naming conventions are too much for me now. I can't remember what on earth is going on. Can you just put numbers like a normal person?
I agree 100%. But of course, back when they did have numbers, they first went to 360 and then they went down to One. So yeah, they're just like, generally confused.
What are you doing, Microsoft? Xbox is a whole thing. But did also come out on Switch, PS4, PS5, although it looks like that was actually earlier this year. I first played this game on Game Pass in 2023, and I was absolutely obsessed with it. I had been intrigued just looking at the art and being like, oh, this is really cool. It looks like, you know, kind of medieval tapestry style or something. And they pull the art style off magnificently, like straight down to the, you know, I'm not entirely sure this artist has ever seen a cat before kind of thing going on.
Yep.
You play the character Andreas Mahler. He is a journeyman artist. He has a job at the Abbey, doing some work there. And he's just, you know, staying with some friends, hanging out in Tassing. He knows all the townspeople there. He's good buddies with people all over the place. But anyway, he goes to the Abbey to work every day. And then there's a murder.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yep. Very, very scary. So anyway, the whole first act of the game is all around trying to figure out basically who killed this guy, because your friend Piero was accused and he is a frail old monk and it seems unlikely that he's the one that did it. So you're like, all right, I'm going to go and I'm going to find out who did it so I can absolve my friend Piero. And then the game progresses from there.
Everyone in town seems convinced that this frail, nicest man on earth straight up murdered a dude for practically no reason.
Yeah.
And every time Andreas is like, this is absurd, you have to realize this is absurd. They're like, I don't know what you're talking about. He clearly did it. And so that already kind of strained credulity. It would be one thing if this is starting to get into other issues, but whatever. It's a story-driven game, so I think engaging with the story primarily is relevant.
Yeah.
It doesn't really engage with power in an interesting way.
No.
And I found that very disappointing, because a lot of the plot beats seem to imply... So, for example, there is a very early discussion on the part of your friends with whom you're staying. Friends, maybe, sort of, kind of. That's another issue. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
Have to pay rent to the Abbey. The Abbey is the local landlord, and apparently the rents have been going up and up and up, and taxes keep getting higher. They used to just take a cut of the harvest, but now they want cash. It was a very common transition in either the Middle Ages or in the Renaissance in a lot of European feudal arrangements. And there's a whole bunch of discussion about what kind of landlord the Abbey is and all that. I'm like, ooh, these are interesting issues. The game doesn't engage with those. There's a whole bunch of intimations that you might be getting into issues about the power of the church with respect to indulgences. The game doesn't engage with that. There's a whole bunch of intimations that the game might engage with how nobles get to exercise arbitrary authority and how you can't really stand up to them on pain of any number of punishments. Game doesn't really engage with that. There's like all these historical elements of the background that I personally, as a user, felt were... This is going to sound terrible. Was just showing off? Like, okay, fine. So you're going to name drop the 95 Theses. You're going to talk like okay, Martin Luther studied at the same university as Andreas Mahler, and we're just going to drop this in somewhere. It's like, are we going to deal with... No. This is just a thing we're going to point to and then move on. Let me point one example. Let's drill down into one example to get what I'm talking about. And then I'll kind of pull it back a little bit. As Andreas is talking to people, the text, the literal font, is differentiated based on the background of the individual with whom he is speaking. So, for example, the printer who operates the printing press in town, because this is after This is after Gutenberg. There's this weird little animation about like him setting out the movable type and then imprinting his dialogue onto the screen. I'm like, that is super cool visually.
Yeah.
And then I took half a step back to it, and then it started getting me almost angry because, number one, the printer's son speaks the same way. So I'm like, okay, what is this doing? Seriously, like the printer's son is... No, I mean it. Like the printer's son isn't a printer. So what is this doing? Okay, so this is just an indication of them playing around with this visual touchstone. Okay, fine, whatever. And then there's this a couple of moments where Andreas is talking to somebody and they have the sort of scratchy script of a peasant. And then they just mention casually that they happened to go to university or that they happened to have some sort of formal schooling. And then what happens is the text gets erased and the text is then replaced with the more formalized Latinate script that Andreas and other university-educated people employ. Again, as a visual touchstone, that's super cool. As a thematic touchstone, what does this represent? And I would posit to you this represents one of two possible things. And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts. Number one, it either represents nothing, in which case that just underscores the extent to which they're showing off for the sake of showing off, which is okay. Or number two, this represents that Andreas Mahler is a hugely judgmental jerk that completely reevaluates his opinion of whom he's talking to on the basis of what their background happens to be. And he's just running around engaging in very, very reductive judgments based on people's class and educational background. I'm not sure which one I'm supposed to infer.
Yeah.
But I don't think I like either of those answers. Am I wrong?
No, I mean, honestly, okay. So first of all, I don't remember very well from when I first played this game like a year and a half ago. But I did go through a bunch of Act 1 recently, and I didn't realize why it was erasing their text and then rewriting it in a different font, and then why they would just speak that way or type that way, whatever. Why their text would be written in that manner from then on. And that makes sense to me. Honestly, while you were describing it, it made me think that it was the latter, which isn't a very good reflection of Andreas.
It's also at odds with some of the ways that you can choose to play Andreas.
It is, yes. That's for sure, because you have a decent amount of control over how you react to certain situations.
Yes. Which then comes to, I think your phrasing is very apt, how you react to certain situations, because you get to stipulate various elements of Andreas's background, you get to stipulate various elements of Andreas's, like, for example, it's established early on that he's in Tassing for his sort of wandering period of apprenticeship, and that eventually he's going to go home to Nuremberg, he's going to get married, and he's going to settle down and be a master artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, his attitude towards his wife, his fiancé, to whom he's never met, you're entirely up. It's up to you to determine how you're going to respond to that. You can be eager, you can be nervous, you could have no intention of following through, whatever. However, I can't help but feel that that's about as deep as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you as Andreas can react to things however you want.
Yeah.
But the ship's going to end up at the same destination no matter how you do it. So you might like it, you might hate it, but guess what? The game has its agenda, and it's going to follow that agenda regardless of what you say about things.
Mm-hmm. Over the course of the game, there's certain things that will be different based on the things that Andreas says or decides. But largely, I mean, it's not a huge branching narrative. There's a couple things that'll change, but the overall flow of the game is going to be the same. The game will always end in more or less the same way.
Yeah, and it's weird. I find it very strange, and I can't say that this is the same people, but I genuinely find it relatively strange that people can play Pentiment and talk about how, oh, I had so much control over things, the choices matter. It's got that stupid little tag on Steam that says choices matter, which is so blanched as to, of meaning as to be useless, and then say that Mass Effect 3 felt like a railroad job. But anyway, mm-hmm. That's a separate discussion for a separate period. That's a whole thing.
Please stay tuned for a message from our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back. I'm a little unclear on what constitutes a spoiler for this game. And some of the things that I want to talk about probably get into most people would consider it a spoiler territory, even though it's just still for the like first third or so.
Then let's put some mild spoiler tags up and people can judge for themselves.
Future Mark here. I have traveled back in time exclusively to warn you that if you want to avoid spoilers, skip ahead 6 minutes and 45 seconds. That's 6 minutes and 45 seconds starting right now.
Okay. So one of the things that I both liked and found frustrating is Lorenz gets murdered. Everyone thinks Piero did it. Andreas is like, okay, no, I'm gonna figure out what actually happened here. And, you know, you learn that there's a variety of suspects that all have some level of motive, opportunity, and you have to pick which one did it. And in the end, you never know whether they actually did it or not. And a part of me likes that. And a part of me is also incredibly frustrated not knowing, like, oh, okay, so we just have to pick an innocent person to die because the Abbey says so, and that sucks. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm in the exact same place. I agree with you 100%.
What I find appealing about it is that ultimately, and they make this clear in the story too, the Abbey is really worried about stuff coming down on them hard because Lorenz got murdered there. And therefore, they have decided that the only way that they're going to get out of this is by getting this murder solved so no one can point at them and be like, oh, they did something bad, you know, we should shut them down, whatever.
And parenthetically, their plan to do that is to pin it on one of their own, which always struck me as a little weird.
Yeah, okay. That is definitely weird. But it's like, okay, so they basically, they don't say it, but they basically say that they just need a scapegoat to pin this on. As the character, you're like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't sound right. Piero's a good person. I'm going to find out who really did this. It feels realistic in a way that you have to just make the best out of a bunch of bad choices. But it also feels bad. It feels bad to know that the person you picked and who's about to get beheaded may not have done it. And there's no way to know if they did it or not.
I think part of it is the fault of the game's execution, to be entirely frank. Because if you decide, so there's a superficial list of people that may or may not have done it. You can just pick whoever you want. And if you just spend time with them, there's a compelling narrative about means, motive, and opportunity that you can come up with for any of them. And yep, it is just a function of who you decide to focus your attentions on. And that makes it feel like a cop-out in a very real way. And that is at odds with the good version of it. The good version of it is life is sloppy. You're never going to obtain perfect information. Mm-hmm. You work with the information you have. And at the end of the day, you have to live with your choices. That's the robust version. That's the good version. The sloppy version is pick who you want. Choose your own adventure. Fill in the blanks. It's murder Mad Libs, right? And it's just any time you devote any attention to any of the possible suspects, it's like, oh, okay, well, there's an entire conspiracy underlying this person. It's like, all right, fine. But it just ends up undermining the quality of that life is hard and difficult angle.
Mm-hmm.
And this dovetails with the time pressure that is at the heart of Pentiment. And when I first kind of understood this, like, oh, great, I love Persona. I love that fundamental structure. I liked the sort of time pressure element even of I Was a Teenage Exocolonist. I wasn't expecting the time pressure to be that pronounced. Like, which is especially troubling because a lot of the stuff that I really enjoyed was just hanging out with the villagers.
Yeah.
They were super well done and interesting. I was experiencing, for what it's worth, when I was loading up Pentiment, I was experiencing a little bit of concern because I remember thinking when playing I Was a Teenage Exocolonist, I don't really feel a lot for these people. They're not really doing much. And then I play something like BioWare, and it's like, look, a BioWare game, it's like, look, I realize the writing here is less sophisticated, but I care about these people. Am I just a sucker for pre-rendered graphics and voiced lines? Is that what's going on? But then 5 minutes into Pentiment, it's like, I love you, I love you, I love you, you're great, you're awesome. No, and I mean it.
Yeah, like, no, I get it.
It's just they're really well-rendered, fleshed-out characters, even though many of them are, to be entirely blunt, illiterate peasants. And it's just, this is great. This is wonderful. This is presented with such humanity and such care. I really appreciate this. And there was this one opportunity where they're like, oh, it's harvest time. We've sheared the wool. We need to put it all in bobbins. It's a day-long affair. Would you like to come out and chill with us? I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. And then there was this lovely social scene where you hang out with a lot of the women of the town and some of their husbands drop by at various times. And then I'm like, oh, I'm never going to be able to solve the murder now.
Oh, yeah, you're not wrong. Because I did exactly the same thing. And it was like, oh, I just had a lovely moment with all these people. And it also means that I completely missed my opportunity to be able to feel like I fully investigated, you know, person A, B, and C.
Yeah. And I wasn't even able to, again, I'm not very good at video games. I think this much has become incredibly clear over the course of time. But I wasn't even able to complete the means, motive, and opportunity bit of the person I ultimately pinned the murder on. In part, and it was so gamey, in part because I would go talk to these people. It's like, we need to do X in order to get the murder weapon. They're like, sorry, we just did the game check and you're 1 point shy of convincing me, so no bueno, no go. And I'm like, great, I'm never going to be able to convince the judge of who's guilty now as a consequence. And then we have this scene where the judge is like, well, can you explain this? And instead of saying, well, I would if I could just investigate this thing, or this is my basis for, I'm 90% of the way towards a conclusion on this issue, but instead the only dialogue option I have is, I've got nothing for you, which is absurd. And then, miraculously, this dude from nowhere, who doesn't know me from Adam, who has had a bunch of people tell them that Piero was the one who done did it, I show up and say, hey, buddy, I've got a half-baked idea about who might have done it. And they're like, yeah, yeah, that sounds good. Let's have that guy's word carry the day. It felt so cheap and unearned. I really think what they ought to have done is just make the game longer. Mm-hmm. Give me a little bit more time. Give me a little more rope. Let me spend time with these great people at the same time as collecting these bits of evidence. It just felt unusually rushed, which is weird because Pentiment is not what I would call a fast-paced game, especially since 90% of your playtime seems to be occupied by running back and forth between the Druckers and the damned Abbey.
That was one of my biggest complaints about the game, is how much time you have to spend running back and forth between two locations. It takes, like, I mean, Andreas isn't slow exactly. Like, it's not like some of the other paces that we've complained about previously, but it still takes a lot. Okay, not that long. I never timed it, but it takes long enough that you're like, oh my God, like, can I please, like, let's hurry it up. Pick up the pace, buddy.
Okay, so that's a lot of complaints. So you said that you became obsessed with Pentiment when you first played it over a year ago. So what were the things that really attracted you to it and made it crawl inside your head?
I think part of it was just that the game has this sense of style that is so freaking cool. Like, I loved the kind of medieval tapestry-ish art style that they've got going on. I love that when you want to look in the glossary, it kind of pulls the camera back from the scene you're in as if you're in a book, and then there's like notes written in the margins about who a character is or what a location is. I think that this game, at least stylistically, knew exactly what it wanted to be, and I felt that it pulled that off really well. I loved all of that stuff, and that definitely kept me kept me going quite a bit.
I think a natural point of comparison is Thank Goodness You're Here, in that they are games of singular vision executed to evoke a tone almost flawlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And Pentiment looks and feels like no other video game world I've ever been in.
Yep.
And that is definitely, I had no difficulty understanding why Pentiment won a Peabody Award, for example. Because for all my criticisms of the story structure and the way things feel and the gameplay structure and all these other things and how I felt like the thematic elements are kind of just tossed out there just to toss them out, no one could say that Pentiment is derivative or a quick cash grab or designed to capitalize on trends. Pentiment is a singular, unique vision. And again, very much like Thank Goodness You're Here, regardless of how you might think of the end product, I am supremely glad of a video game market that can support such an offering.
Mm-hmm,
and I certainly didn't regret my time with it, despite all my misgivings. So there's that. I mean, and again, the fact that it's on Game Pass makes it extraordinarily accessible to any number of players, just to be able to see the style and the its sense of place and time that it evokes. It's a singular achievement. I just kind of wish they hadn't decided to shackle it to a murder mystery, honestly.
Mm.
There's a bunch of other stories they could have told. And if they decided to make it a murder mystery, was that really the best lens through which to lean in its strengths? I don't think so.
Yeah, because the game, I mean, they have all these characters, which I also just fell in love with over the course of the game. Even just seeing how Andreas's life progresses through each act, like it's awesome. Like I loved 90% of the stuff that I got to experience in it. But the fact that it's like, here's a murder. Okay, you solved it. And then, oh, oops, there's another murder. Just FYI. Second murder.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's like, really? Like, what made him the town detective? I mean, just being there and being willing to do it, I guess.
If Pentiment had been the story that I thought it was, namely of a guy not at home who's got his periods of wandering, deciding what he wants to do with his life, deciding how he even feels about his own faith. Because again, Pentiment, it didn't delve into these issues with nearly the same level of depth that I would have liked. Again, Pentiment is supremely nerdy, but it's not nerdy about the things that I wanted it to be nerdy about. I can talk about reformist theology all damn day. But I respect the fact most people don't want to do that in their video games. And so I guess it's a minor miracle that Pentiment even gestured in that direction. But it was no more than a gesture. Had it been a little bit more substantial in that sense, like there's this discussion very early on in the game between Piero, the guy who gets fingered for the murder falsely, we think, and Mahler about what his art is meant to represent, mm-hmm. and about what kind of artist he wants to be. And I'm like, I want this to be the game. This is what I want the game to be about. But instead, it's about a weird half-baked murder mystery. And I just felt that that was a missed opportunity. And I wanted the slower, more contemplative, more introspective version of Pentiment. And so to a certain extent, I was disappointed.
Coming as a person who actually absolutely loved this game, despite the issues I had with it, I agree with you that it would have been better. Like, because those were the moments, I think, where the game really shined versus just being like, oh, I have to pick somebody to get beheaded. So BRB. And like, that also felt bad because honestly, especially in first act, I liked Lucky. I felt bad for Otilla, I think was her name, the widow. I had empathy for the nun. So you know who I picked? I picked the prior Fenrink. Fenrink? I don't know. Whatever his name was. Fenrink. Because I didn't like him. Like, I mean, that's not exactly why I did it. I was still able to pick a reason why I thought he did it. But that ultimately, that's kind of what it came down to in a way.
To be fair, all of my criticisms are largely about what I wanted Pentiment to be, what I thought Pentiment was going to be. In fairness, some of that because of things that Pentiment was gesturing towards that I thought it was going to manifest. And so it was, but they were just, again, I hate to use the term, but it was kind of like they were just showing off. Just like, hey, 95 Theses, you heard of that, right? And it's like, could we? All right, fine, you're doing this for other reasons.
Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed Pentiment, But again, I constantly felt like it was not playing to its strengths. This is a common criticism I have of video games. At least better to have those strengths there than not.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, I think that it didn't live up to the kind of narrative that I wanted it to be. Maybe there are some people who are like, yeah, I want The Name of the Rose. I think every medieval story should be a murder mystery. Bam. But at least The Name of the Rose, the murder mystery hinged on some interesting areas of medievalist thought. And that, Pentiment, is how you show off.
Oh, Mark.
Look, I'm sorry. I'm sympathetic to people who want to name drop a whole bunch of scholars they read when they were in undergrad. But that doesn't necessarily make it a compelling podcast, video game, or movie or television show.
Yeah, that's fair.
As Immanuel Kant would say, out of this crooked timber of humanity, nothing straight could ever be wrought. Anyway, with that in mind, let us move on to some shameless hyping of upcoming titles, a.k.a. Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out for us?
At this point, I'm just being a parody of myself. But I'm going to shout out Critter Cafe.
Yes!
So, it looks cute. And by the time this episode airs, it will already be out because it comes out November 26th. But anyway, the gist of the game is you get to design a cafe, run a cafe, you get to explore through some mysterious portals, which feels a little at odds with some of the other bits, but I don't know. And you get to rescue critters and then, you know, design little habitats for them where they'll be safe. And it sounds cute. So I don't know. I kind of want to try it.
Have you played the demo?
I have not, but I did see that there was a demo and I would like to try it.
It says that you can create a wholesome cafe for all to enjoy.
Yep.
Until late in the first act, there's a murder you need to solve. So
can you imagine?
Yeah, and it's not a good vibe.
Yeah.
I, too, am going to play True to Type, and I'm going to shout out a game that's in early access and therefore frustrates me because I want it to be a real game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's another roguelite. It is described as a roguelite claw machine deck builder, and it is called Dungeon Clawler.
Oh, my
God. The way that it works is you have a claw, like as in from a crane game, that descends and picks up various balls that are mods and or attacks that you launch, and it drops it in the chute, and they trigger one by one. So it is a arcade claw game used to power dungeon crawling, and it looks incredibly stupid and amazing. It is available now in early access, but once it is a real game, I look forward to trying it.
Oh my God, that game looks wild.
It's a scene.
Also, I love the game. Although when I Googled it, Google was like, no, clawler is not a word.
It is now.
And clearly you want crawler. And I was like, no, Google, that is not what I want. But anyway.
So it's on early access now, which means it'll probably be a real game somewhere between 2025 and 2042.
Yeah, it just came out in early access. Yeah, you're not seeing that game for a long time.
I'm just putting it down here in part so that I can remember. I should just maintain a spreadsheet of all the games in early access that I want to release. Fortunately, they're all on my wish list, so once there's a 1.0 release, I do get a special update about that. So
yeah. Oh, man. Early access. It's a thing.
Strange how I keep adding more and more early access games to my wish list, and yet I don't get a corresponding equivalent rate of games entering full release.
Yeah.
A cynic might be forced to observe that some of them are languishing in early access forever.
What?
I know, that's just wild conspiracy talk. So, that's going to do it for this week. For all my best friends are digital, thank you listeners so very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. And we hope to see you again soon. Please do take care.
Thanks, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week.
Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save.
$20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.